From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. It's Monday with Mayor Marty Walsh. He joins us in studio to take your calls. We'll talk immigration agents in Boston, inequities in the Boston Public Schools, and changes to the city's zoning board.
I want to assure the residents of Boston that they can have confidence in the Zoning Board of Appeal and that we will protect what we love about our neighborhoods as we grow and evolve.
Call in at 1-800-423-8255. Helen Drinan, president of Simmons University, is stepping down this spring after successfully guiding the school through disruptions in higher ed and the Great Recession.
It was July 1, 2008. We didn't have enough money. Cash was practically at zero. Everything that could go wrong was going wrong.
We talk with her about her life as a woman leader in Boston. That's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and today is Monday with the Mayor. Boston Mayor Marty Walsh is with us again in Studio 3 for one of his regular monthly check-ins. Welcome back, Mayor Walsh.
Thank you. It's good to have you. Thank you for having me.
It's good to have me, too. It's good to have you.
I'm going to ask you questions today.
There we go. Oh, man, I did not prep for that. Listeners, you can ask questions, too. Call the mayor. What's on your mind? What would you like to ask him? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or send us a tweet at Radio Boston. You can also comment and watch this conversation on Facebook Live. Visit Facebook.com/Radio Boston. All right, so let's jump right in. You had a press conference this morning where you announced some changes to the Zoning Board of Appeals. You want to catch us up and tell us what you announced?
Yeah, basically what we want to do is we want to change the standards of ethics in this Zoning Board of Appeal and be more transparent. I think one of the biggest changes for the public, what the public's going to see, is an omnibus person inside of the Zoning Board. This is the person that won't be taking positions on issues, will be in there. So a lot of what we do in the Zoning Board, what gets press or play is the big projects. What doesn't get press or play is the small projects. So you get a neighbor or somebody that wants to put a deck on their home or what have you, and they don't know the process and they don't know how it goes, and they're going to be able to sit in that room and walk somebody through a situation to help them out. That's probably the biggest outward-facing piece. And we're also going to put the ability online for people to be able to make comments on projects, whether they like the project or don't like the project, be able to comment rather than send a letter in and have it into the record that way, be able to put them online and through computers. The other thing is, let me just read this just so you have it.
Okay.
The executive order, which takes effect immediately, it also adds stronger disclosure requirements for members and their business partners, an annual statement of financial interest, a comprehensive training in ethics, zoning law, zoning code, and board procedures at the time they're appointed or reappointed. So they go to the city council, they get appointed or they get reappointed, and they have to go through this training again just to have it fresh in their mind. We're going to have a ban on voting on projects that have that somebody has had an interest in, provided service for 5 years before the filing.
And it used to be like 2 years.
It used to be 2 years. State law mandates 2 years. We're going five, which goes further than the state. A two-year ban on business dealings with projects that they have voted on, which goes beyond state law. I think it's a 1 year. So anything you vote on, you can't work for a developer or somebody after the fact for 2 years. And we're going to strengthen the financial disclosure requirement for commercial projects before coming to the board to find out who's involved in the projects. Oftentimes, people will put LLCs in there, and they'll be kind of, might not disclose who all the members are, so we'll know who they are. The online system is obviously modernizing the online system for the applicants and for the residents. I mean, that's something that's a lot more open and transparent. It is open right now, but it's open through the process. A lot of times you have to come in.
So basically we've got making it more user-friendly, especially for sort of smaller players, changing the look-back conflict of interest rules to 5 years, so you can't have had a financial interest on something you're voting on for five years in the past. You cannot engage in a financial interest in something you have voted on for 2 years into the future.
Yes.
And you're doing some training and new financial reporting requirements annually for the zoning board members.
Yes.
Okay. So let me just ask a couple of questions. Enforcement on that could be tricky. Sort of, how do you know what someone's engaged in 2 years after a vote. So how are you thinking about enforcement of the financial reporting, the conflict of interest for the 2 years out, et cetera?
Well, you have to constantly, you're going to be filing disclosure forms.
So that's how you'll
We're going
to
be seeing it on the disclosure forms when people file their forms.
Okay. And the other question is, these changes do come. John Lynch was sentenced back in January to 40 months in prison. He's a former city employee. He took money from a real estate developer in exchange for attempting to influence a key vote. Were these rules in response to the Lynch case in particular?
Well, he alluded to the fact, I don't know if he alluded, but the U.S. Attorney's Office, when they sent the press statement out, that John talked about having influence over a Zoning Board of Appeal member, which prompted us to have two reports done, one by Sullivan of Worcester to look at the operations of the Zoning Board of Appeal that's been in place since 1965. And the second was, which was actually the first, Brian Kelly, former U.S. prosecutor, to actually look into the Lynch case in particular. He came back with no wrongdoing by any board member or by the Zoning Board. And Sullivan Worcester came back with some recommendations, of which were released today, but a lot of those recommendations were adopted today. And then tomorrow, we have the City Council has a hearing on a home rule petition that Councilor Edwards is leading. We're working closely with Councilor Edwards on any other changes to change the makeup of the Board of Zoning Board of Appeal. We need a home rule petition, state legislation, so we can't just arbitrarily add and change and move through there, because this was created by statute in 1965 or 1964, I think. So we're working with the City Councilor and with Lydia Edwards and other council members. So after the hearing tomorrow, we'll take a look and see what was talked about, and we'll see what if anything we send to the State House.
And again,
we need another home rule petition. We need another approval by the state to change our laws.
Any concern that the more strict ethics requirements may make it harder to put people on?
Yeah, I mentioned that today a little bit. I think it could cause a little bit of havoc. But you want to make sure that you have people that are willing to work under the rules that we have. And I think that I would rather be safe with having more stringent requirements and ethics laws than have them loose.
Okay.
And that's something that, we'll deal with that when the time comes, if a person comes up. And if the person's not willing to do the regulations that are placed in front of them, then we'll go on to another person.
Okay, I want to shift gears now. There's a lot I'd like to discuss in education and education equity. And we actually have a caller who called in about that. So why don't we start with a caller question? We've got Matt from Jamaica Plain on the line. Matt, go ahead.
Hi, Mayor Walsh. I just wanted to ask you if you have any plans to address the inherent inequity in the tracking system in the Boston public schools, especially how families can pretty much send their kid to private schools and then just take advantage of the test school system when their kid comes of age.
Yeah, I appreciate that, Matt. This is a report that was done. Yes, it was a story in the paper yesterday talking about the Latin school and the test Latin school. The superintendent, Brenda Casilius, has put forth an RFP for a new test that's going to be an exam school test, an assessment for the three exam schools, Boston Latin, Latin Academy, and John D. O'Brien. The RFP is going to ensure fit. The test is aligned with the Massachusetts curriculum standard, is bias-free, and measures students' knowledge and readiness for high school curriculum. We can't prohibit somebody in the private school sector to take the Latin school test. I mean, people pay taxes and they have every right to it if they want. But what we're trying to do is increase the diversity in our exam schools to get more kids of color that better reflect the makeup of the Boston public school system. That's something that's important. What's really sad here is that ERB, which is the company that BPS used for over 20 years for this exam school admission, it's unfortunate they chose publicly to issue misleading and selective information in their efforts to defend the product. And I think that's kind of caused, again, another conversation going on with these schools. But I honestly have full faith and support in Superintendent Casilius and what she wants to accomplish here, along with having our test available in all of our public schools for this year for the first time. We've doubled the...
Meaning on a weekday rather than on weekends
offered. In their school, so they don't have to go to it. Like, usually you'd have to go to another school, take the test, but they can take it in their school if they choose. And also, we've doubled the exam prep. Part of that is by funding by the school department and funding by another foundation, the foundation that I have, to do more prepping, to prep our kids to take the test.
Let me just jump in. I want to give the number to listeners again. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation, like the question that Matt from Jamaica Plain just asked the mayor. So the Globe did a piece this weekend on the exam schools, looking at sort of 20 years of effort to change the admission process or figure out how to increase diversity of the students in the schools. You just talked about two things that the new superintendent wants to do. One is a new test. The other is expanding the test prep that's available.
We did that 3 years ago.
But the new test is what Brenda Casilius is working on now, the RFP.
Yeah, the
RFP's
just out.
About. And you have done the expansion. I think last year 775 students took advantage of the test prep.
It's been 3 years now, test prep.
So what I want to ask you is, so that doesn't change the basic current admissions requirements. Do you feel that the combination of a new test and this expanded test prep over time is sufficient to close that diversity gap?
Let's be honest. I guess my question back is, what else do you do?
I think that is the question.
People are saying, some people, maybe not in Boston, but in other places, are saying, get rid of the test. I'm not going to get rid of the test. It's an exam school. That's what it's always been.
And is that why you don't want to get rid of the test? Because of this concept of it being specifically an exam school?
It's an exam. It's three exam schools. And I think that what we have to do is not just, I think we spend so much time focusing on the three exam schools and not really focusing enough on the other schools. And part of our reorganization, our high school redesign, is to pull our other high schools up so there are options for parents. The Boston Public Schools need to be options for other parents. It can't all just be on the three exam schools. So it's also doing better curriculum in the classrooms. And DESE's about to release a report in the next couple of weeks. We're working with them
right now.
Department of
Elementary and Secondary Education.
They do a study every 10 years on, every 3 years on schools. In Boston, last time we did a study was 10 years ago. So we're working right now with DESE. That report's going to come out. It's not going to be a real pretty report.
Do you have an idea of what's going to be in it already?
We have some. We're reviewing it now. The school department's reviewing it. But it's important for us at the end of the day, regardless of what the study is, that we show that we need to be one great district for every single student. We've seen a decrease of 1.9% in our graduation rates this year in 2019. They're still higher than 2017. And over the last 10 years, they're up significantly. But making incremental gains is not enough. And we have to continue to make investments. That's why we're making a $100 million investment into the core of the schools. The issues that are going to come up under the DESE report are going to be special education, I'm assuming, going to be transportation, facilities, all of these things that for a lot of years there was some work on, but not comprehensive plans. And we're going to continue to make sure that we make the investments and the attention need be to improve all of our schools.
Do you think there's a chance that you're going to get a recommendation for the state to have more involvement in the public schools?
We'll see. I might welcome them in. I might bring them in.
Can you talk a little more about that?
I think. Let's be quite honest here. I think a lot's been written in the paper on one-sided stories, not giving enough credit to the district and what's been done there. We're talking about an area, a school district of 56,000 kids. A third of those kids that go to those schools are kids that English is not their first language at home. 4,500 of those kids are homeless kids. Two-thirds of those kids live in poverty. We have buildings that were built before World War II that we depend on to have our kids educated in. There was no plan before I became the mayor to fix those buildings. A lot of people talked about it, but there was no plan. What we've done in the last 6 years is we're building out new nutrition centers in our schools, in the cafes, and half our schools have new cafes in them, and we're going to build another new cafeteria, I should say, and we're going to build up another bunch of them. The bathroom issue that was highlighted is decades in the making of ignoring the problem in the physical plant. So there's a lot of work that needs to be done here, and I think that by simply saying it's not simply just instruction in the classroom, it's also wraparound services. It's making sure that our kids are that we're doing the work that when they leave our classroom, a lot of them go home to they don't go home to a home. They're homeless, or they go home to extreme poverty. So it's not just simply the educational piece in there. It's a lot of other things that we have to do.
I really want to pull that out, and I'm just going to put the number out for listeners who might want to call on education one more time: 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I do have a caller here, but when I get to him, he's going to change the subject, and I want to stay on this a little bit longer before we go to him. So the Globe has run stories on the graduation rate, which you talked about, the exam schools, which you talked about. We know the DESE report is coming, which you talked about. underlying all of that is a set of challenges that are specific but not unique to Boston. The other major cities are having these same challenges.
They are.
Challenges around race, poverty, mental health, childhood trauma, investment in schools. It's a big, gnarly problem. How do you get your hands around it as an elected mayor? And what do you say to people who are living it and feeling like, for 30 years, if I've been a resident here, I'm struggling with these same challenges?
And it's a big number of students and families. So when you think about that big number, roughly 50% of that category you just described, 50% of that category, if you took the state as a whole, 50% of that category, that population of kids that are living in those situations or working in those situations or going to school in those situations, live in Boston. And it can't just be throwing money at a solution and changing just the curriculum in the classroom. It has to be wraparound services. Last year, we were able to make investments in school nurses in every single school. We increased our counseling. We have to increase our counseling again, put more counselors in the classroom, because our kids are dealing with very big challenges outside the classroom. So we're expecting our kids to come into class and learn pre-calculus when, in fact, that they might be coming out to school hungry, or they might have had a situation at home last night that was a traumatic situation. And I think it is about a comprehensive, full, inclusive programming. And when I interviewed Brenda Casilius for this job, she came from the state of Minnesota, mm-hmm. and I asked her, I told her that these are some of the challenges that our kid faced, the biggest district by far in New England, quite honestly. And she understood that, and understanding that the need to work with the state. When you asked me the question about the state partnering, we have to partner with the state, because DSS, DYS, all those different agencies that we interact with along with the school department, we need to have relationships there that we can work with them, so that if a kid is in DYS right now and that kid gets released out of DYS for committing a crime and they come back to our district, we can have support services for that young person. If we have a family that's dealing with DSS in their life for whatever reason, and there's young people in our schools going to schools and their parents or their mother or their father is dealing with DSS, well, there's complications at home that families are dealing with, addiction or mental health or what have you. So it's about making sure that our kids are given that chance. There are success stories of young people that have had very traumatic childhoods, if you will, who have gone on to do amazing things. We just don't have the scale in the district as of right now where those young people are putting on a pathway to success.
So there are two sides to having the state engage. The other question is, so on the one side, wraparound services, mental health supports, emotional help, follow-up after state engagement. The other is the question of state receivership. Do you have any concern that coming out of this DESE report, there might be other schools going into state receivership?
I'm not even going to go there right now. I think we're in the process of dissecting the report and seeing exactly what the report says. We're not even at that conversation point yet. I think we're still at the conversation point of making sure that the work that we're doing and the foundation that we've laid, you know, over the last 6 years since I've been mayor, we've done plenty. We've done a lot. We've made investments. So some of the benefits here as well. I mean, we have performing schools. We've seen the state gave a report the other day that we're making significant improvement in a lot of our districts. We have more level one and level two schools right now than any other school in the history of our schools. We're building more new schools right now, quite honestly, than any other period, maybe since the beginning of our district. So we're making investments in places. We're doing the cafes, the cafeterias, working with the Shaw Family Foundation and bringing healthy, fresh food to our district. So there's a lot of good advancements made. This is not a solution that can be fixed. This has been about four decades
of
turmoil.
Yeah.
And you're not going to turn around in 3 or 4 years.
I'd like to grab a listener call here. I'd like to talk with actually Dave in Malden is on the line, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-TALK if you'd like to be a part of the conversation. Dave from Malden, go ahead. What would you like to say to the mayor?
So I'd like to say that I worked as a social worker for the best team, the Boston Emergency Services team.
Hey, Dave, can you keep your mouth nice and close to your phone? You're kind of cutting in and out a little bit.
Can you hear me?
That's better, Dave. Thanks.
Okay. So I worked for the best team, Boston Emergency Services team, as a social worker. So I went all around Boston when there was a crisis. And I went into schools, and it was very obvious, you know, schools that had low funding, you had broken windows in certain schools, and other schools, you know, like Newton North, that are doing very well. And so this is an issue that's been going on for decades, but for some reason, no one seems to notice that this is a systemic issue. We tend to blame people as individuals, but really, individuals are created by society.
All right, let me give the mayor a chance to respond to that, Dave.
I guess I don't know what your question is, Dave, but I know that we can't compare most Boston schools to Newton North. You just can't. I mean, you're talking about two high schools, I think, in Newton North and some
Newton
South.
North and Newton South. So,
and we're talking about 35 high schools in Boston with very different challenges. And I don't think, I'm certainly not, and I don't think this conversation we're having today is blaming individuals at all. I think that in a lot of ways, the system, maybe you're saying this, the system has failed people. And I think that in a lot of ways, I've seen it, whether I've been a state representative or I've been now as mayor, the system has failed people in having programming to help people get out of the situation, whatever that situation might be they're in, but not fully helping them all along the way.
Okay, so I'm going to get us ready for a break here. We're going to take a break. Listeners, when we come back, we're going to talk about how the city is preparing for the coronavirus. But in the meantime, on that subject, Mayor Walsh, you held a lunch in a Chinatown restaurant last week to support restaurants there that have seen a drop in business because there's been
50%.
Concern around the epidemic and some racism and some holding back. So with that in mind, I guess I'm curious, what's your Chinese takeout order? Like when you went to that Chinese restaurant, what did you order and what do you love to eat?
They put food on the table for me.
Oh, so you didn't get to pick?
Yeah, I didn't get a chance to pick, but there was a couple shrimp dishes, a couple meat dishes, some dumplings, some rice, some chicken, a whole bunch of different orders on there.
So are you an omnivore, it sounds like?
Yeah.
Me too.
When I go there sometimes, if I have lunch with other people from Chinatown, we'll have dim sum. Mm-hmm. And then I guess you'll have the, I don't know what you call it, the American Chinese food, when you get takeout in the store. But I think this weekend was a little better in Chinatown. More people went back. And what I was really happy about, a friend of mine texted me after she saw me on the news that night saying that she was going to go to a show into Chinatown the next day. So I asked people, you know, please use the businesses down there. The wait staff, the people that work in those places, the dishwashers and the cleaners and the cooks, they're hurting. And if you have a 50% drop in business, then what means at some point you're going to need a 50% drop in staff.
Yeah.
And those folks depend on those jobs, really. And this is something that is really important. Chinatown is safe. It's clean. I'm asking you to go down and use it.
All right. 1-800-423-8255 if you want to call over the break to talk with Mayor Marty Walsh. Everybody stick around. We'll be back in just a minute. I'm Tiziana Deering, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I am Tiziana Deering, and I am still here in Studio 3 with Boston Mayor Marty Walsh, Mondays with Mayor Walsh. Mayor Walsh, thanks for sticking around.
You're welcome.
All right. So we said, listeners, before the break that we were going to shift gears now and talk about the coronavirus. We also like to talk a little bit about immigration and community violence and the time we have remaining with the mayor. If you want to have a conversation with the mayor, ask questions on any of those subjects, give us a call, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And just a heads up that you can also comment and watch this conversation on Facebook Live at facebook.com/Radio Boston. So I do want to talk about coronavirus, or I think it's being called COVID. There are some fears globally now, Mayor Walsh, that this could become a pandemic. We're seeing some big jumps in cases. Italy went from 3 cases last week, 152 cases yesterday, 219 cases today. South Korea, 833 cases, and reported 150 new cases just yesterday. Now, as of right now, Massachusetts happily has had one case.
One case.
But do you have concern with the rapid increase that we're seeing in countries and large cities about a change in the state of the coronavirus in the city of Boston?
As of right now, the risk to the general public is very low. The city of Boston has taken many steps to prepare to respond to the virus as we continue to be confident that we're in good position to respond however needed. Certainly, to take words what you just said, there is a lot of fear and uncertainty worldwide about this outbreak. And you know, I think it's at the latest numbers, I think 2,500 people, 22,000, maybe 2,200, 2,500 people have lost their life in China.
It's in the thousands.
And it's scary. There's no question about it. We are making sure that, you know, the screening system, and I don't know if this is because of the screening system, but when the federal government changed the way people coming into the country are changed. I think it's 8 airports that people come through. There's a screening process that happens there, and I think that is important to have, just to make sure.
And
that
Logan is not one.
Logan
of
is not. We were at one point. We weren't in the very beginning. We were for a short period of time, and we're not there anymore. And I think that is one that unfortunately you need to do that right now, just to make sure if people have the illness or the sickness they have. We also have the best medical facilities in the world. That if somebody does have coronavirus or test positive for it, we have the best hospitals in the world. world right here in Boston to try and deal with it. I think the bigger question is at some point the conversation has to shift of how do we stop the virus? How do we address the virus on a worldwide stage? How do we address it in China? And I'm assuming our CDC is working with the Chinese government in trying to do this.
I mean, do you see any potential for Boston to be a leader, given some of the things that you just laid out, for the leadership for Boston in this some way?
I'm sure I can't speak to what our hospitals are doing, but I'm sure our hospitals are involved in the conversation. But I do think that, as we head into warmer months here and we think about tourism and moving forward, Boston is an international tourist city. And the marathon's coming and people start to come that weekend and then forever on. And we do have an awful lot of visitors that come from China and businessmen, people that come from China to visit our city and to do business in our city. And I think that at some point, I haven't read anything yet about the conversation around what are we doing to stop and prevent the coronavirus from happening.
All right. So just one of the producers was just telling me, actually, Harvard Medical School has announced that it's going to be a research partner with China on the coronavirus.
Thank you for that.
You talked about tourism. You reached out to Sony asking them to change their mind after they pulled out of the video game conference PAX East. Have you heard from them? Have they answered?
No, not yet. Not unless they've answered since I've been here. We sent a letter, I believe, on Friday. That's something that's very concerning to me. David Gibbons from the Convention Center Authority called me to let me know that Sony was pulling out. And again, the concern is if Sony pulls out, then who else pulls out of the convention business? It's similar to the Tokyo canceling of the marathon. Or just allowing the elite runners to run. And then in Boston, there was conversation about the BAA looking at it. I think that, it's a very serious issue. I'm not saying you can't overreact. You have to take everything very seriously. But let's not overreact in certain cases, if that's the case. That's my concern.
Let's grab a listener call, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've got Sam on the line from Jamaica Plain. Sam, go ahead.
Hey, Mayor Walsh. I'm one of your constituents from Jamaica Plain. And
Sam,
I live a few blocks from Doyle's, which was a landmark restaurant that we lost last year. And a big reason was because they were able to sell their liquor license on the private market for over $400,000. So my question to you is, what can Boston do to regain control of our liquor licensing authority from the State House and make it so that a neighborhood like Mattapan, which doesn't have a single sit-down restaurant, can have the same sort of opportunities to have a dining scene like we have in the Back Bay and Seaport?
Thanks, Sam. I've been working at this since I've been the mayor. One of the first things we did, along with Councilor Presley, is to regain control of the licensing board in the city of Boston. Up until 2014, that was under the control of the state, appointed by the governor. It's appointed now by the city and the mayor. The next piece is we have what's called these license quotas that we have to go to legislature and ask them for certain quotas of licenses. And I would like to see that lifted and allow us the opportunity to be able to have licenses. I mean, a great point Sam brought up is not everyone in all of Boston is looking for a full liquor license. Some are looking for beer and wine, and some are looking for to serve cordials, and others want a full license. And we if we don't have the licenses available, we can't give them out. And I think that's a big problem. The Doyle situation partly was because the license was worth so much money, and I think there were some other issues there as well, Sam, while Doyle's closed. But you're absolutely right. We Mattapan is a target neighborhood for us to get some restaurants in the Roxbury area, in parts of Dorchester, in High Park. And, we'd like to see restaurants coming, and even Jamaica Plain, seeing different restaurants pop up, small restaurants, because I think people like to be able to walk down the end of their street and go to the restaurant in their neighborhood rather than get in a car and drive to, wherever they drive to eat.
I think. Let's grab another listener question. We've got Charles on the line from Milford, Massachusetts. Charles, go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I'm calling in regards to what I heard about a year ago, the dredging of the Boston Harbor to bring in bigger ships and tankers, and I haven't heard any more about it. I was just curious what the status is.
They're dredging right now, Charles. If you go out there, you'll see out in the Boston Harbor, if you go down to Castle Island and you look out the back, you'll see a barge out there with a crane on it, and they're dredging the harbor now. What they're doing is they're creating a waterway. Right now, Boston can take ships that carry 5,000 containers on their ship, and when the harbor's dredged, they're going to be able to take container ships up to 7,500 container ships. So it's a major port in the Northeast that we'll be able to have here in Boston.
Happening now. Excellent. All right. This one came in through the online request from WBUR for questions for the mail. We're going to shift gears here because this is a question about ICE. This is at Boston Stuff, and they ask, what is Mayor Walsh's reaction and actions against the ICE commandos newly stationed in Boston? So he's referring to the new Federal Border Patrol agents, the specially trained agents.
There's no one, as far as I know, there's nobody's positioned in Boston. It's a conversation. ICE was claiming that Boston was one of the cities in America.
Are you saying that's not actually going to happen?
I don't know. No, he's saying the one stationed. You read it, stationed.
Yeah.
There's no one stationed in Boston that I'm aware of right now.
Okay.
And we have been checking with the commissioner every day, and we haven't heard it. And there's actually a story in the Commonwealth Magazine by the local ICE director,
Tim Lyons.
Lyons. I think he made a comment that he didn't think this was going to happen.
So in the Commonwealth magazine,
I think I might have got that wrong, but I read that. But there's nobody here right now. And I think that, you know, listen, I'm not going to say this is never going to happen, but this is like the third time or fourth time the president has put this threat out there. It's the first time he's mentioned Boston. But I stay in very close contact with my colleagues in the U.S. Conference of Mayors, the mayors of New York and L.A. And around the country, all the cities that were targeted on the list. We talk on a regular basis, and we have not seen any uptick in activity as far as people coming from the border. I think that from what I understand, the border has enough issues, so they need to keep the agents down there and not bring them up to Boston.
Todd Lyons, I apologize to you. I combined Jim Lyons and Todd Lyons in my head and wound up with Tim Lyons. Yeah. The name is Todd Lyons. I do want to ask you, so I've been paying attention to this, and I also, you know, recently became aware of the Trump administration taking away the right for global pre-check and some other travel options for the state of New York in response to the bill in New York that allowed undocumented immigrants to obtain driver's licenses. Yeah. Is the Trump administration trying to intimidate the city of Boston?
Not that I'm aware of. I think he's trying to intimidate every person that's an immigrant in this country. I think that that's wrong. And I think that, you know, we have I just think that, you know, Boston, I've said this in the past, 28% of our residents are from another country. 48% are first generation like I am. We are truly a city that's immigrant city, immigrant friendly. And we don't have these problems that the president has claimed that happened, where crime goes up and the economy goes down and you know, people exodus the city. That's not happening in Boston. It's quite the opposite in Boston. And I think that this fear of what's happening. What I'm disappointed in, quite honestly, even in listening to the conversation around the Democratic debates, is that nobody's talking about immigration reform. And you know, that's the issue. The issue here is how do we make sure that the 13 million people in this country that are undocumented, what is the pathway to citizenship? If you want to deal with alleged excessive immigration in our country, then let's come up with legislation and let's have a vote in Congress. I mean, we have schools being affected by the immigration policies of students that come here from other countries to get educated in our colleges. By the way, they pay the full boat of fees. We have people that come to this country going to work, and we learn from their expertise and they learn from ours. We're in a global economy, and right now there's this conversation. It seems like every 3 or 4 months there's this big uptick of fear about ICE coming in, and nothing happens.
I do want to say that WBUR has confirmed that there are some of these ICE employees working in Boston, whether they're stationed here.
No, ICE has an office in Boston.
No, I mean some of these special, I don't want to call them special forces because I feel like that's hype that doesn't help the discussion.
Yeah.
But these specially trained people coming from, who were stationed at the border and are now coming.
I don't know
Boston.
If that's, maybe if they said, I mean, I'm sure if they have it, they've confirmed it, but I've not heard that.
All right, we have 1 minute left and I have a very important question for you.
Yes.
Mookie.
Oh, God.
How you feeling about Mookie going to the Dodgers?
You know, when I saw his video, it killed me. You know, it killed me.
It was painful.
It was awful. It was talking about Boston and about he was, you know, he's a great person. Mookie Betts, I mean, we all heard the story after the World Series.
Leader.
He brought the food down to the homeless people and homeless in front of the library. And, you know, he was involved in our community. He's a big loss to our city. He's a big loss to our baseball team. He's a huge gain for L.A. Congratulations and good luck to L.A. Well, not too good luck to L.A., but congratulations to L.A. But, you know, he's going to be a big loss because he was a classy, classy kid who brought us a World Series and a lot of good memories. So thank you, Mookie Betts.
All right. Boston Mayor Marty Walsh, thanks for doing one of your monthly check-ins with
Thank
Mayor
you.
Walsh here
See
on
soon.
Radio Boston. Stay tuned. There's more coming up. I'm Tiziana Deering. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. It is a leadership kind of day here on Radio Boston, so we're going to spend the rest of the hour today with another key Boston area leader, Helen Drynan. She's retiring in June as the 8th president of Simmons University, Simmons College, when she started. She's led that institution through major disruptions in the economy and higher education. Drynan also served as a senior executive for Caritas Christi Healthcare and for Bank Boston earlier in her career. Throughout all of that, she has made women's leadership and education a key goal. So as she prepares for her retirement, she joins us again in Studio 3, President Helen Drynan. Welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Tiziana.
It's
glad to be
here.
Thank you.
So we've known each other for a long time. We've worked in some of the same professional circles, worked in the Archdiocese. You came to Simmons in 2008. It was a college then. And it was in a very tough position, and it was the beginning of the 2008 economic massive recession. Now it's a university. It's had some major fundraising campaigns, $100 million. How would you describe your tenure as president in the last 12 years? 11 and a half.
Well, I think it's fair to say that it was a turnaround situation, and it was also a massive series of problem solving that had to be done. You know, colleges and universities are complicated places, and certain things are foundational. So finances are foundational. And when you arrive at a place and they don't have any cash on hand, they can't meet payroll, and they've got big obligations, it's a tough situation.
That's making my heart race just listening to that.
It's not a good feeling.
What did it feel like to take over under those circumstances?
Well, it felt like the biggest thing was, how could this possibly be? And when you look at the financial picture of the university, we'd been losing money steadily for years. But one of the arcane things about higher education is the way that finances are reported. And sometimes they are very straightforward, and sometimes they're very, very complex and difficult to understand. And ours were in the latter case. So it was really after I got there that I learned how complicated and how serious the financial situation was. But, you know, in some ways, the Great Recession was our friend.
How?
Well, in the sense that everybody was worried about the finances. Even solid, rock-solid organizations were worried about their finances. So the fact that we had really big reasons to worry were kind of out of the public mainstream. There weren't people running over every day asking us, what were we doing now? And that helped us, because some of the work we had to do was really painful.
So what did you do? Because now we're at 2020. Mm. Simmons is Simmons University. It has survived the great disruption of small liberal arts higher education. So how did you get from point A to point B?
Well, you know, I'm really an accidental president. Very few presidents have my background in banking and healthcare. Most of them...
You mean university presidents?
Yes, yeah. Most of them have come up through the ranks, and they have terminal degrees, typically PhDs. And I don't have any of that. And I was an active member of the board before I became president, and we had a very sudden leadership change, so thrust into the role.
Your predecessor had been there fewer than 2 years.
Right, exactly right. And so really, I was so grateful that I had this accidental background, because the fact that I had lived through serious financial situations at both Bank Boston and Caritas Christi and other kinds of serious situations at both gave me a lot of tools to deal with this. Most people who are in higher education really would not have been as well suited to do this, even though, of course, everybody wished that I had a PhD and I were an academic.
Were people – I mean, traditionally, academic institutions, their members are very resistant to non-traditional leadership. Did you greet or meet a good deal of resistance?
Oh, my goodness, yes. People jumping on tables saying, no, 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 no. I'm not kidding. It was that
actual
bad.
Table jumping.
Yes. However, I think after a couple of months when they saw what we were looking at, actually several people came up to me and said, I'm really glad you're dealing with this. So, you know, we got over it. Now, that perception of not being a true academic has pertained my entire tenure there. But after a while, you know, it just doesn't become an issue anymore.
So, Helen, it seems the conventional wisdom is that you were able to do the turnaround at Simmons largely through embracing online education. Would you say that that's an accurate assessment of sort of the financial success the university's seen?
Well, I would say that's true, but it's easier said than done. When we started in online education, it was a strategic decision to advance our very strong but local graduate professional education programs. And there was not a lot doing that right at that time.
We tried
at the graduate level. We tried our own local opportunity, and it just – we couldn't do it. We absolutely couldn't do it. And we luckily made partnership with an organization called 2U that essentially provided the upfront capital to provide incredible marketing and incredible technology. And we went from our first year in 2014 of generating about $4 million in revenue to 2018 generating about $79 million in revenue.
So that's huge change, but that's got to be leveling off. I mean, there are so many entrants into the marketplace of online education now.
That is true. And there's no question there were fewer than 40 competitors, for example, in online nurse practitioner degrees when we started. And now there are over 200. But I really do look at this, Tiziana, as a question of then what's the competitive response to that? You can't just
say,
well, gee
innovation?
Whiz, you know, it's softening. It's getting harder to do this. Well, so what's our response to that?
So let's talk about a couple of the tougher things. You have encountered controversy at various times in your career. At
yes.
Simmons, there have been a couple. One, there was news out this month from Moody's Investor Service,
yes.
who revised its outlook for Simmons from stable to negative,
yep.
which could mean it could threaten the bond rating for the university.
Right.
Because there have increased debt load, $140 yep. million plus $77 million more to renovate some campus buildings.
Right.
What is your reaction to that?
So I find it really fascinating that the headline was Moody's warns Simmons. If you actually read the Moody's report, you'll see lots of positives in that report. And they don't really often write lots of positives. Between Moody's and S&P, they have essentially taken the same position, hold on the ratings, lower the outlook. And the message is essentially Simmons has done a great job of managing under difficult circumstances, making expense reductions when necessary, and inline online education way longer before others. We think they can do this. Now, if indeed in the future they can't, we'll be watching, and that's why there's a negative outlook. So we're on watch. We're having a leadership transition. That is not unusual for people to watch us. But actually, I got a note from our banker and from our advisor that both said, congratulations on not having a ratings downgrade. So nobody in the press is celebrating that we maintained our rating when two of our neighbors, whom I will not mention, did a similar thing and both got downgrades.
Okay.
So it's a big deal not to have your ratings moved under these circumstances.
Okay, so let's just talk about a couple other things. Then I want to move on to some women's leadership
yep.
questions too.
Yep.
Just I'll put these together. The two other controversies that did come forward during your time at Simmons, mm-hmm. one was your executive compensation,
mm-hmm.
which was relatively high. I put mm-hmm. you at the time 13th on the list.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 2018, protest over a white man being selected as the first
right.
dean of the Gwen
right.
Ifill College,
right.
Gwen Ifill being an African-American, a late alumna.
Right.
Of the college.
Right.
I just want to ask you to touch on both of those.
Okay, the first one, my compensation. The peculiarities of reporting 990 compensation is you report every dime paid in the year it's paid, and then you report it all again in the year when it's paid out. I had a 5-year deferred compensation arrangement that was intended to make me stay at Simmons. I would have lost all that money if I had left Simmons. They didn't pay it to me until 2016. I had earned it over 5 years. But since they paid it out all at one time, it all came into line. If you had actually looked at it on an annual basis, it wouldn't have been notable at all. And if you look at this year's Chronicle, you'll see there are very much higher paid people than that. It was an anomaly of the counting.
And how about the Gwen Ifill
situation? So Gwen Ifill situation is really a very, very sad chapter in the life of Simmons University. Gwen was a revered alumna, and her family agreed to give us her papers so people could come and study her papers at Simmons. And then kind of on the cuff, I said to Bert Ifill, what about if we named the school for her? And he said, I have to ask the family. So he did. Now, long story short, it is not the Gwen Ifill School of Communications and Journalism. It is the Gwen Ifill School of Media, Humanities, and Communications. So the notion that we would pick someone that looked exactly like Gwen in person as well as in profession was never on the table. But for a subset of our alumni, they thought it was. That they thought that was the absolute mandate. It was not the mandate. And the person that we hired is incredibly capable of running the school that we have, not necessarily the one that our alums wished we had. They have really been outspoken beyond belief, and we have essentially tried in every possible way to bring them back into the fold. But I just think it's a situation that they can't get over.
All right, we don't have a ton of time left, and I do want to make sure to get to some other subjects
yep.
with you. So
yep.
here's your big philosophical question
mm.
for the hour today. Would you say you are a woman leader or are you a leader who is a woman?
I would say I'm a leader who is a woman.
Can you say some more about that?
Yeah, I would never choose to be a woman leader.
How come?
Because I think that if you are trying to build a career, and I certainly have done that over the course of my life, you have to be the leader of everyone, not just of the women in the room. I remember that President Obama was really called on that. And he said, I have to be the leader of all the people in the United States, not just the people who look like me. And I really think that is true of a leader. I also think that women do bring different skills and capabilities to the job. So it's fine to be conscious of being a woman as a leader. But you can't just lead women. So I'll give you a quick example. I am very much in favor of the changes that are now arising around Title IX violations that allow the so-called perpetrator to have an opportunity to speak for him or herself, and it's usually himself, rather than the former rules that essentially meant if the woman said it happened, the preponderance of evidence was the test to see if that worked. A number of men, who many of them might even still qualify as boys, have been thrown out of colleges on the basis of testimony that they never even had a chance to even oppose. And I just don't think that kind of thing is correct because
so you're
at the
referring
end of the day,
to what Betsy DeVos has been looking
yes,
at.
Yes, I am, which Harvard Law School opposed from the beginning, the original ways that we had in place. I just think things like that, that's just not fair. And that's where a woman leader can step forward and say, well, I'm very much in favor of the right things happening for women, but does it have to be at the expense of the wrong things happening for men?
So that's an interesting example for you to choose, because, of course, one of the other things that I wanted to ask you about is both the hashtag MeToo movement and the fact that whether you intended to or not, to some extent, your experience at Caritas Christi Healthcare System, where you raised issues of the CEO, Dr. Haddad, having been guilty of sexual harassment and then first being resisted in your recommendation of his termination by the Archdiocese, and then later his resignation was enforced. That was fairly early on in our discussions in the workplace about sexual harassment, et cetera. Were you pioneering something at the time? And do you think that it's gotten easier for people in those kinds of positions like the one you were then to report that kind of thing now?
I don't think I was pioneering. I had had many experiences in my career at Bank Boston that were not of that magnitude, but there were at least of that ilk.
He was accused of kissing employees and calling them at home and
right.
talking about inappropriate personal matters, et
right.
cetera.
But this is what I would say. I went back when I was looking at the Harvey Weinstein case. Harvey Weinstein, the allegations about Harvey Weinstein started before the incident with Dr. Haddad. Now, think about that. That means that the incidents that sort of welled up under the hashtag MeToo leadership had been going on for a very long time. And if you look at some of the other people who have been similarly accused, their track record's pretty long, too. So what I think is the fact that we actually brought that forward at Caritas was an example of doing the right thing for the women in the organization and not being pressured by the fact that he was the senior person, the fact that he had strong friends outside the organization. But it wasn't because the organization did that. It's because at the end of the day, the women came forward and said, this should not stand. Now, when you think of the things that Dr. Haddad was accused versus the things that Harvey Weinstein has been accused of, and there was a judgment today in his case, in this day and age, the things that Dr. Haddad did, nobody would even say, is that sexual harassment? They would say, it is. That's just the end of it. So when I was involved, it was a much more prolonged, early days kind of sense. Today, I think people know sexual harassment when they see it, and it doesn't have to be as serious as Harvey Weinstein.
We have about a minute left.
Yep.
You know, this happened in the context of the Catholic Church. Last year, you and I actually talked on air here about an op-ed that you wrote
yep.
about the Archdiocese and Cardinal Sean.
Mm-hmm.
How are you feeling as a Catholic woman today?
You know, I feel actually much better than I did in the depths of the Dr. Haddad situation. I stopped going to church for a year. I just couldn't reconcile my own feelings with my church. And over time, I've really gotten much better at understanding that the church is a human institution, only as good as each and every individual that's running it. And it's one of the reasons why my belief is people who know how to run large organizations should be running the business side of the church and let the holy side of the church stay with the clergy.
Well, we're going to have to end on that
yes,
note.
Yes, we will.
That is Helen Drinan, the 8th president of Simmons University, a post that she assumed in 2008 and will step down from in June of this year. President Helen Drinan, thank you.
Thank you, Tiziana.
And that is our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Walter Withman. Tim Skoog is our technical director, with engineering today by Max Liebman. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I happen to be Tiziana Deering, and I sure hope that you will join us again tomorrow when there will be more Radio Boston.